This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Today, part three of our year-long monthly series, Battleground 2020, How Pennsylvania is Defining Presidential Politics. Coming up, how environmental concerns about fracking and the good-paying jobs in the natural gas industry are causing splits in the Democratic Party. But first, a look at Pennsylvania as an energy producer and consumer. Pennsylvania is rich in fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas. Its nuclear power plants are a primary source of electricity, and it's growing its renewable energy sources, including wind and solar. We asked Christina Simeon to give us an overview of Pennsylvania's energy sector. She's a senior fellow at the Kleinman Center for Energy Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. She's currently a doctoral student in advanced energy systems at the Colorado School of Mines and the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, also sits on the board of Philadelphia Sustainable Energy Fund. And Christina Simeon, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. Let's begin with fossil fuels. Why is Pennsylvania so rich in fossil fuels? Is it location, location, location?
Yes, location along the Appalachian Mountain Range. So you have a lot of natural resources in the ground coming from the northeast corner of Pennsylvania, crisscrossing the state. I say crossing the state to the southwestern portion. So most of those resources are in rural areas of the state.
And in the, obviously the western part of the state as well.
Yes, the southwest, exactly, along that Appalachian mountain range.
Now, I read that Pennsylvania is the third largest energy producer in the country. Is that correct?
Correct, behind Texas and Florida. And we export about 30% of this, at least on the power side, to other states.
And we're talking fossil fuels, renewables, nuclear, things like that?
So Pennsylvania is the second largest producer of natural gas, owing to the shale resources, again, along that Appalachian Mountain Range. We're the third largest producer of coal. And even though the coal sector nationally has been experiencing a downturn kind of related to the rise of natural gas, we're still third in the nation in production. We're second in the country in nuclear power production, at least those were the numbers prior to the closure of Three Mile Island, which is a single-unit nuclear power plant. But we're also fourth in energy-related carbon dioxide emissions.
And that would be, of course, the pollution that comes from these energy sources.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about the it's not like the Marcellus Shale exactly got discovered because it's been there all along, but how the natural energy industry using hydraulic fracturing, how that has really transformed the state when it comes to natural gas production.
Right. So the advances in drilling technologies that allowed these shale formations to be economically tapped has really transformed Pennsylvania. So prior to shale production, let's say around 2008, Pennsylvania produced only about a quarter of the natural gas that it used and had to import the rest, mostly from the Gulf states. Now, Pennsylvania is actually exporting about 80% of the gas it produces. Within a little over a decade, it's been a significant transformation, and that transformation has done a lot of positive things, like lower natural gas prices for consumers. It's also lowered power prices for consumers as we've kind of switched from coal to gas for electric power production. That has come with some decrease in carbon emissions. It also has created a lot of jobs in the industry, whether it's fuels processing, fuels transporting, or through power generation, brought a lot of investment to Pennsylvania. It's also created a lot of wealth for rural landowners who maybe didn't have a lot of economic opportunity, but if they were sitting on a parcel of land that and they owned the mineral rights to that land, they would have some kind of royalty rights or rights as surface landowners. So it has created a lot of economic opportunity. The Environmental benefits are mixed. Again, a reduction in power sector emissions, but there's a lot that remains to be, there's a lot of questions about the overall emissions related to natural gas production. And if we are really measuring and tracking those emissions accurately, for example, the amount of methane and other emissions that occur in the gas production side, where we're not metering or not really capturing and quantifying those emissions accurately. And there's some technological advances that could improve that.
And we're going to pick up on that with our guests who are waiting in the wings. I was reading that there are something like 77 trillion cubic feet of natural gas reserves in the Marcellus Shale. I don't know what that number means. Is there any way to translate that?
So it is a bit of a mysterious number because the reserve calculations are often based on what is deemed to be economic and the economics change over time. But it is suffice to say that that Pennsylvania is sitting on the Marcellus and the Utica shales. I mean, some people say it's the largest reserve in the country, if not second to Texas.
So obviously we're dealing with a huge sort of underground reservoir of natural gas.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
I'm curious, and we're going to be talking about how fracking and natural gas has divided specifically and most particularly the Democrats in Pennsylvania. But I wonder also about where we stand when it does come to things like renewables, like wind and solar, and maybe even water. How does the state stand coming to those sources of energy?
So basically, you know, in 2018, we got most of our, let's talk about electric power. Most of our electric power came from nuclear, about 40%, followed by about 36% natural gas, maybe 20% coal, and then about 5% non-hydro renewables, like wind and solar and biomass, and hydroelectric renewables. So a very small portion of renewable energy. In September 2019, Three Mile Island closed down. So the most recent data shows that now in the power sector, natural gas is the number one fuel source for power production, a little over 40%, followed by nuclear and coal, and still, you know, around that 5% kind of hydro and non-hydro renewables. So it's very small.
You were talking about how natural gas has, for certain parts of the state, has really meant jobs and it's meant money, even wealth, for people that potentially own land where this can be drilled. Do we know how the jobs are created by all these various sources of industry? Do we have reliable numbers on that?
So the reliable numbers, that's a big question. I think people need to remain really skeptical whenever an industry group or an advocacy group comes up with some, you know, job numbers or job claims, because the assumptions around that data really, really make a big difference. But there's a very good report that the National Association of State Energy Officials put out, and that has some credible numbers. But overall, what I'd say is when you're trying to compare fossil fuel jobs and renewable energy jobs, you have to remember with renewable energy, there's no fuel that needs to be taken out of the ground and transported and then fed into an electric power machine or generator. And on the one hand, that makes the power a lot cleaner. On the other hand, those are jobs and that whole fuel processing, transporting, feeding into the generator, that all creates jobs. So in Pennsylvania, yes, there are far more jobs related to fossil fuels, whether it's in fuel extraction, power generation, or transmission, distribution, and storage. But there are a good amount of jobs in the energy efficiency sector. Some of that is more kind of traditional HVAC, heating and cooling. kind of thing. And there are jobs, a smaller amount in wind and solar, around, you know, about 8,000 or so, according to this report. Fossil fuel jobs are more around the 90,000 mark.
Just by way of comparison, obviously talking about a kind of work that is just more labor intensive if you're getting things out of the ground.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. There's a whole fuel supply chain associated with those jobs. Now, on the other hand, it makes those energy sources far more volatile to price commodity swings. So you have the renewables. You have a free fuel, so to speak. So there's less volatility, and there's you don't have the emissions issue. And I think the most important thing to point out is, the externalities associated with combusting that fossil fuel is currently not priced into the market, and that's a failure in our markets that kind of distorts this whole picture.
I was also reading that we're only a couple of months into 2020, but sort of expecting a bit of a downturn or even less demand for natural gas this year, maybe even looking into the future. Does that make sense to you? Are we seeing that?
I'm not sure. I think there's been such a rush to gas in Pennsylvania because gas power generation, especially the more advanced combined cycle technology, is very cost competitive to build. It's relatively easy to build from a permitting construction standpoint. And if the plant can situate itself close to a natural gas pipeline, it can access gas in a very economic manner. So there was a big rush to investment. I think that is probably going to cool down for a variety of reasons. There's a lot of uncertainty about, especially in this region, about how these power generators will be priced in regional markets. The mm-hmm. regional power grid is called PJM interconnection. And there's a big debate at the federal level about, can states that operate in these competitive regional markets, can they subsidize the generation that they want through things like renewable portfolio standards or zero emission credits for nuclear power plants? Or is that something that the federal government needs to kind of step in and mitigate in order to protect competitive dynamics? It's a very complicated argument.
Well, a lot of moving parts. And Christina Simeon, thank you for joining us. Thank you for getting our conversation started.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Christine Simeon, Senior Fellow at the Kleinman Center for Energy Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. She's a board member of Philadelphia Sustainable Energy Fund. Getting our conversation started, it's Battleground 2020. We're taking a look at energy in Pennsylvania, specifically how fracking is dividing a lot of voters, specifically Democratic voters and Democratic leaders in the state. Do stay with us. We've got two guests who'll be joining us after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Moscow-Wain, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Today, it's our third installment of Battleground 2020, and we're looking at how energy politics in Pennsylvania is revealing divisions among Democrats and could influence the outcome of the 2020 presidential election. As we just heard, Pennsylvania has become a leading producer of fossil fuel in this country ever since natural gas in the Marcellus Shale was discovered more than a decade ago. It's revitalized western parts of the state with some good-paying union jobs. And while natural gas releases fewer greenhouse gases than coal, fracking is not without serious risks, including methane and leaks. Concerns about weighing climate change and the economic benefit of gas production have become one of the most contentious issues among Pennsylvania's Democratic voters. Senator Bernie Sanders and some Democratic Party leaders want to ban fracking, while Vice President Joe Biden, Governor Wolf, and more moderate Democrats want to take a slow approach. We asked Umair Irfan to join us. He's Vox staff writer covering climate change and energy and the environment. He's also a contributor to Science Friday. Before joining Vox, he was a reporter for Climate Wire at ENE News in Washington, D.C., where he covered health and climate change and science and energy. Umair Irfan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. Also with us is Reed Frazier. He's an energy reporter for the Allegheny Front and State Impact Pennsylvania, also co-host of the Trump on Earth podcast. And Reed Frazier, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. Let me get us started with two clips. The first one is Joe Biden. He's being confronted by a climate activist. This is at an event in December about his climate plan, which does not call for a ban on fracking. Let's give it a listen.
I've looked at your climate plan. Why doesn't it ban fracking?
Why doesn't it ban fracking? Because you can't ban fracking right now. You got to transition away from it. Look, you're going to ban fracking all across America right now, right?
I would love to.
Yeah, I'd love to, too. I'd love to make sure we can't use any oil or gas, period, now. Now. Is it possible?
Yes.
Well, you ought to vote for somebody else.
That was a little bit noisy. He's talking about, I really think we need to transition away from fracking. It does not support, or at least did not back then, support a fracking ban. Here's Bernie Sanders declaring his support for a complete fracking ban. This goes back to 2016. It's a position he still holds in his current bid for the White House.
In my view, if we are serious about safe and clean drinking water, if we are serious about clean air, if we are serious about protecting the health of our children and our families, if we are serious about combating climate change, we need to put an end to fracking, not only in New York and Vermont, but all over this country.
Reed, let me begin with you, and let's just talk about how this issue is dividing Democrats in the state of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I mean, what you're seeing, especially, I mean, I live and work in Pittsburgh, and so what you're seeing in our part of the state are sort of more establishment-type Democrats who are saying, hey, let's pump the brakes on this fracking ban. We've got all these good-paying union jobs coming in to this region in the form of there's a big chemical plant being built here. There's also big pipelines that are being built by a lot of union labor. So, you know, Western Pennsylvania is traditionally a big big union base, union area. And so the Democrats that are most affiliated with those trade unions are in, you know, want to pump the brakes on any talk of a fracking ban. They think that will alienate a lot of their voters. But you also have, you know, these sort of insurgent part of the party here locally. There's some Democratic socialist type elected officials in Western PA who are saying we need to get out of the fossil fuel industry. We need to ban fracking. And so there's going to be a big, this is just part of our political culture now, is this clash within the Democratic Party between how far do you go on this issue?
And certainly something that will be debated going forward in this state. Umair, let me get you in on the conversation. Is Pennsylvania kind of a ground zero for this debate over fracking, the environment, energy, jobs?
Yeah, I mean, you see a microcosm of a larger energy debate playing out in Pennsylvania, you know, as a big energy state that has a long history with energy. Pennsylvania, you know, is where a lot of these issues are coming first and foremost. And you may recall Governor Tom Wolf early last year, said that he would commit Pennsylvania to reducing its emissions by 80% by 2050, which was one of the more aggressive goals, particularly since, Pennsylvania is the third or fourth largest greenhouse gas emitting state in the country. So that's a pretty ambitious target. And as Reed noted, yeah, there's a big debate as to the role of fracking in getting toward that goal, depending on, you know, how ambitious you want to be. And it's really interesting seeing that play out on the ground there.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about the pros and cons of fracking. And Umair, I'll begin with you, but Reed, I want to make sure that you get to weigh in on this as well. Let's talk, Reed, on the pro side of fracking. You did a big article in Vox about this. What are the pros?
Well, the pros have to do with the record of fracking. You know, it's been, as your guest at the top of the show noted, like it's cheaper. And that means that it has displaced coal, which is the dirtiest source of energy. It's not just in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, but also things like sulfur pollution and nitrogen and mercury. So it's helped improve air quality. Natural gas produces about half the greenhouse gas emissions per unit of energy. And not only that, but like one of the side effects of natural gas is that it actually helps renewables get onto the power grid, because the way you use natural gas in a generator, you use these combined cycle gas turbines. These are generators that can ramp up and down pretty quickly, unlike coal turbines, which have to run basically at full blast all the time. And what that means is that it makes it easier for grid operators to integrate variable wind and solar power. So in the time that we've seen the fracking boom, we've also seen renewable energy in the United States double. So, and, you know, the grid has stayed stable. And so that's the record that natural gas has had on the U.S. power grid. And that's what proponents say we should continue on if we want to continue decarbonizing going forward.
And just to make sure everyone understands that, that natural gas is for those cloudy, rainy days, or the days when the wind is not blowing, and it helps to sustain the natural gas resources. The green energy resources.
Right. We are still trying to develop energy storage and other kinds of measures to sort of balance those out for renewables. But in the meantime, natural gas has been filling that role, and it's been doing it quite well. So well that, you know, as renewables have, you know, increased vastly and dropped in cost, you know, natural gas hasn't really impeded that, but has largely helped that as well.
Do you want to weigh in on that, Reid?
Yeah, I mean, I think what he said is right. A lot of coal plants have closed in the Pittsburgh sort of airshed. Upstream of us, and the air has absolutely gotten better in terms of criteria pollutants like particles in the air and things like that. And so it absolutely has pushed coal off the grid. I think there's a big but coming, so I don't know if we want to take that yet.
Let's do it, because there's a pro and there's a con, but go ahead, Reid.
Just on the climate side, and I know Umair's written about this, but, you know, the natural gas system does leak a very potent greenhouse gas into the atmosphere that sort of gives back some of the climate benefits of using natural gas versus coal. And studies have shown that we're underestimating the amount of this methane that's getting into the atmosphere by either between 30% and 60% or something along those lines. So it's not there's a hidden greenhouse gas cost to natural gas that we're not really pricing into the carbon benefits of it.
And let me pick up on that, Umair. Do we know the amount of methane that's released?
No, and that's the part of the problem, is that it's been really difficult to track because we have fracking infrastructure as such a distributed operation all over the country. It's been difficult to regulate. It's been difficult to monitor. And, you know, a lot of environmental groups who've done their own measurements of fracking sites keep saying that, you know, these companies are underreporting their emissions. And some researchers, particularly Robert Howarth at Cornell University, he estimates the overall fracking leak rate is about 3.5% of methane, which, as Reid noted, is a very potent greenhouse gas. It's about 30 times more powerful than CO2. And so a small leak of methane can easily overwhelm any gains you get from switching from coal to natural gas. I'll point to the Aliso Canyon natural gas leak in California. This was that long-running leak a few years ago that basically the emissions from that overwhelmed any gains that California made that year in terms of cutting its greenhouse gas emissions, just that one well, just that one leak. So this is not trivial. Even if you're talking, you know, single-digit percentage points of leakage, it's still something significant that has to be controlled.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Umair Irfan, Vox staff writer, covering climate change, energy, and the environment. And he had a really interesting and very relevant to Pennsylvania article recently looking at the pros and cons of fracking. Fracking is dividing the Democratic Party here in Pennsylvania, with some members of the party who oppose the ban on fracking that's coming from people like Senator Bernie Sanders, others calling for a sort of slow ban on fracking over time. Vice President Joe Biden speaking to that. You can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Rita, I just want to go back to you, and I was talking with our first guest about do we know how many jobs have been created by all these various energy sectors. Help us, though, for those of us who live in the eastern part of the state, how natural gas and all the related industries has transformed parts of the western parts of Pennsylvania.
Sure. I mean, there's no question that natural gas has been a boost in certain counties in western Pennsylvania, Washington County, which is just south of Pittsburgh, and now Beaver County, which is just west. I mean, you have jobs drilling the wells. You have jobs laying the pipeline, building the compressor stations. I mean, once these wells get up and running, you don't need that many people to operate them, which is how, you know, if you needed a lot of people to operate these wells, that would take away some of the profit incentive for the companies to build them. So the big thing right now in western Pennsylvania is sort of a downstream effect of drilling for natural gas, which is we have all of this gas that's really good, easy to turn into plastic, called ethane, and the Shell is building a very big chemical plant that will do just that here, and it's something on the order of the biggest industrial project in western Pennsylvania since World War II. It's a massive 6,000, you know, union workers, or, you know, craft workers, they're called, are building this plant just west of Pittsburgh, and so there's a lot of the workers, it needs to be said, are, you know, coming from out of state because this region just simply doesn't have enough of the highly skilled, highly trained workers that need to be used in a project of this scale. But, you know, those folks are staying in hotels and eating in restaurants, and so the argument goes they're really helping the local economy. And right now I did look at the labor numbers. That Shell construction manager is the largest employer in Beaver County right now. So that right there tells you something.
Absolutely. Let me read a couple of emails, and then, Umair, I'll go back to you. An email from Dave: I think we should celebrate the Marcellus Shale. It's one of the reasons why the U.S. is energy independent. An email from Bob: thanks to fracking technology, we pulverize shale with toxic liquids, contaminating drinking water. How about just leaving it in the ground and focusing on renewables? Can you talk a bit, Umair, about just there's a lot of water that is used in fracking, but some of the concerns about what happens to the quality of that water?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a very water-intensive operation. You're pumping water underground, and then once that water gets pushed back up to the surface, you have to discard that wastewater. And, in Oklahoma, for example, those wastewater reinjection sites have led to these earthquakes, actually, that they've been able to measure, a huge increase in those as well. These are not severe earthquakes, but it is something that is alarming to local residents. And the other thing, I mean, to note about fracking is because it's such a distributed operation, a lot of people are closer to it than they are to other sources of energy. About 17 million Americans live within a mile of a fracking well. So this is something that people are more directly exposed to, not just in terms of things like, you know, water and other kinds of chemicals, but also like air pollutants and things like, you know, benzene and other kinds of hazardous chemicals. And that's why you've had these kinds of ballot initiatives in other states to put setback requirements on fracking wells. And in Colorado, in the last election, you may have seen that there was an initiative that would have effectively banned fracking in the state, but that was voted down on that during that election.
Reed, let me go back to you. There have been some polling. I'm not sure how current it is, but a number of polls looking at where Pennsylvanians stand on this issue of fracking, whether they support a ban, whether they support fracking, or something in between. What do we know, and are there regional differences?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think just to be simplistic about it, I think it's safe to say people are split in Pennsylvania about the question of whether or not we should ban fracking. Some polls go a little bit in one way, depending on the question, and other polls another. I mean, I'll just give you an example just real quick. One of the polls noted that Maryland and New York both have moratoria on fracking, and then asked them, would you support a similar moratorium on fracking? And that poll was 48-39 in favor of a ban on fracking. Now, another poll just asked people straight up, do you favor a ban on fracking? And that was almost the numbers were almost switched. So I think it depends on how you ask it. But, I mean, I think it's safe to say that people are mixed on it. And, yes, there are regional differences. The biggest opposition to fracking is in the big cities, Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. Actually, Philadelphia, I think, had in the crosstabs of that poll, the fine print was the biggest opposition to fracking. And around Pittsburgh, Southwest County, outside of Southwest Pennsylvania, outside of Allegheny County, where Pittsburgh is, was the biggest opposition to a fracking ban. So I think you can see where this stuff is enmeshed in the local economy. People are more opposed to a fracking ban.
And has that created tensions in communities or between neighbors or friends, workers?
Oh, I mean, yeah, sure. I mean, it can get very heated in these local communities when, you know, there's a local laws or zoning decisions that need to be made. I mean, it's just been really interesting. Sometimes these decisions come down to what a local zoning board decides about, you know, a certain setback. And in some communities, there have been, like, for instance, there's a community just outside of Pittsburgh in a sort of affluent suburb that basically, they didn't ban fracking, but they basically all but banned fracking in their community. And you saw, you know, folks who were wanted it to go in because they stood to gain and benefit, really mad about it and angry and saw it as sort of other people taking away their property rights.
Omer, we're almost up at a break here, but is that happening in other states out of curiosity, just this sort of almost neighbor against neighbor?
Yeah, exactly. You do see sort of this divide between urban and rural, but also, you know, between big cities and smaller towns. And people that are actually close to these fracking operations and financially more dependent on them obviously tend to be a little bit more favorable. But I also wanted to pick up on a couple points that Reed said.
We have to take a very short break. I'd have to interrupt you in about 5 seconds. So just hold on to that thought and we'll get back to our conversation. It's Battleground 2020, something we're doing every month on Radio Times, taking a look at issues that are of interest to Pennsylvania voters, could decide the 2020 presidential race. And we're looking at the pros and cons of fracking, of natural gas. There are calls for bans. There are calls to go slow. Umair Irfan and Reed Frazier are guests. You can join the conversation, radiotimes at whyy.org. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Ray.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Go Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about the debate over the call for a fracking ban has divided the Democratic Party in Pennsylvania, in many ways pitting environmental concerns against good-paying union jobs. This is part of our monthly series, Battleground 2020. Umair Irfan joining us from the NPR studios in Washington. He's a Vox staff writer covering climate change, energy, and the environment. Reed Frazier joining us from the western part of Pennsylvania, energy reporter for the Allegheny Front and State Impact Pennsylvania, also co-host of the Trump on Earth podcast. Let me play one more clip, and then I know, Umair, you want to say some more things, but this is President Trump addressing the Shale Energy Conference in Pittsburgh. This is October 2019, praising the energy industry in the Marcellus Shale region of Pennsylvania and Ohio, and lamenting that other states like New York are limiting fracking and natural gas pipelines.
Nobody does it better than the hardworking men and women of Marcellus Shale Country. Wouldn't it be great if New York realized what they're sitting on top of before the competing states take a lot of it? You know, it gets down a little bit, right? Keeps going down. They'll say, hey, we used to have a lot of energy before they took them from Pennsylvania and Ohio. But New York should do it, and New York should allow pipelines to go through so the people of New England can cut their energy costs in half, so the people in New York could cut their energy costs in half. New York doesn't allow pipelines to go through.
Clearly, this will be an issue fought out in Pennsylvania. Umair, you wanted to add a few things right before our break.
Yeah, just wanted to pick up on just the polling point, just that looking specifically at swing voters in Pennsylvania. I mean, a poll I saw showed that while it's only about 40% that want to ban fracking, about 70% said that they do favor policies like the Green New Deal and strong environmental action. And so that's one of the things that's going to be difficult to reconcile for this campaign, is just the fact that voters do want a plan to deal with climate change, but they're divided on the tools to do it. And the just the other point that Reed was pointing out was just that a lot of regulations that govern fracking are done at the local level. And so while we're talking about this in the context of the presidential election, there actually aren't that many levers that a president actually has to limit or restrict fracking. A lot of that is going to have to be done with state and local environmental rules.
I'm assuming, though, on public lands, the president, whoever he or she is, that they have some degree of control over that?
That's right. I mean, some of the candidates have talked about, you know, putting a moratorium on new fossil fuel leases on public lands, but fracking in particular takes place mostly on private land in the United States. And so even a lever like that wouldn't do much to dissuade fracking.
Here's a question from Mike. How much methane is released naturally? Can your guest speak about recycling methane released from landfills, biomass, I guess? Reed, do you want to take that?
Sure. I don't actually know how much.
Okay.
I know that a lot, you know, the oil and natural gas system is one of, if not the biggest sources of methane emissions in the United States, if not the world. Certainly, agriculture is actually a very big source of methane. Famously, cow burps.
Right.
Not the other way.
Yep.
It's actually a big, it's a big issue. So, I mean, none of this is like the silver bullet, you know, ending one of these sources for climate change. It's a lot of sources for this. But if I could, I just want to go back on something that you guys were talking about, which was, can a president just ban fracking? And I think the answer is probably no, according to experts. But I did talk to one expert who, somebody who watches, like an energy analyst type, who watches this space a lot, and said, you know, when Trump said he was going to bring back coal, that's kind of like what it's like when Bernie Sanders says he's going to ban fracking. People know, I mean, I think a lot of people understand that, you know, Bernie's, if he were to be president, couldn't just ban fracking. But it's a signal, like, what are your priorities? What is your level of commitment to something? So it's that sort of take him figuratively, if not literally, or something like that.
Something like that. I always forget which one goes first. Reed, that's, I think, a really interesting and important point. Let me read a comment from Bruce, and Umair, I'll put this to you. He said, I just opted into a Philadelphia program that allows you to get your gas from landfills. Is that a potential for energy, maybe cleaner energy?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of talk now about what they call, you know, renewable methane, essentially methane derived from things like waste dumps, like, you know, landfills, but also things like farming and things and biomass. And the idea is, of course, that you're either repurposing waste that would have otherwise gone into the atmosphere, or you're just simply recycling carbon through biomass. And that's a potentially viable option. It's a questionable, though, whether you'll be able to get to the scale needed to match the amount of gas that we get, the gargantuan amounts that are out there that we get from fracking. And insofar as that it's available, I think, yeah, possibly it's a good option. I'm just not skeptical that it'll make a meaningful dent in the overall picture.
Reed, here's a question from Suzanne. She says, is it true that most of the jobs generated by fracking go to non-local workers? You were mentioning what's been happening in Western PA. Can you speak to that?
Issue. I mean, it's less of an issue than it was 10 years ago in Western Pennsylvania. But, you know, these are very specialized jobs, and they don't, it's almost like a circus in that way. Like, there's only, I mean, you need certain skills to be able to work on a drilling rig. And the drilling rigs, where they move around to where people are drilling. So I think there's more, I mean, I haven't seen any recent numbers, but I think there's more Pennsylvania and sort of more generally local workers, Ohio, West Virginia, Maryland, if you want to keep those, consider that local, versus Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas. But, I mean, I think, you know, it's a specialized industry, and these sites move around the state, so, you know, it's not like a permanent workforce the way, say, a coal-fired power plant or a coal mine, that you can't move around a coal mine, those jobs mostly go to local people.
Umair, let me go back to you and going back to your article in Vox. One, you said an interesting thing, which I hadn't really thought about, which is that natural gas has created lower energy prices, but that has then had an impact on fuel efficiency. We see more SUVs, we see more air travel, and that it's had a kind of paradoxical effect on emissions.
Right. I mean, I think one thing to emphasize here is that fracking doesn't just produce natural gas. It produces oil. The U.S., because of the fracking boom, has become one of the world's largest, I think the largest oil producer, crude oil producer in the world. And that's had a huge impact on our economy. Having cheap oil has, helped us get out of the recession, but it's also undermined the case for things like electric vehicles. In the U.S., I mean, major auto companies, companies like Ford, have basically given up on building sedans. They think American customers only want crossovers and SUVs and these minivans. And so what that's ended up doing is essentially pushing people towards bigger cars and less efficient cars than they would have if fuel prices had been higher. And right now, transportation is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States, beating out the power sector. So this is a significant problem. So on one hand, yes, fracking natural gas has led to the reduction of coal use in the U.S., which has helped, you know, see decline emissions overall, but it's boosting oil, which is now potentially undermining those gains.
How does natural gas compare to nuclear power plants, Umair?
Well, it's nuclear in this context is a lot like coal in that they have a lot of fixed costs. I mean, nuclear power plants have zero operating emissions, and that's what makes them good for, you know, climate. I mean, about 60% of U.S. clean energy comes from nuclear. But because natural gas is so cheap, it's undermining nuclear for the same reasons that it's undermining coal. And those nuclear power plants, now there are several of them that have been facing early retirement because of that. And when those nuclear power plants go offline, that capacity is replaced with natural gas. And so that leads to a net increase in greenhouse gas emissions rather than a reduction.
And Reid, we should say that TMI closed down in Pennsylvania.
Three Mile Island did close down, and there's another nuclear power plant, actually right near the chemical plant, that's closing early because it's getting they're just getting crushed by natural gas. It's so much cheaper, and they cannot, you know, run these plants profitably. And there's been lots of efforts in states, Ohio, Illinois, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. It didn't go anywhere in Pennsylvania to subsidize these plants long enough to get some sort of national carbon policy that would, because nuclear energy produces far less greenhouse gases than fossil fuels, it's in some ways a green source of energy. And, the states have been trying to make up for the lack of a national policy on carbon to greater or lesser success.
Let me pick up on a couple of things, and I'm looking at the clock here. Umair, let me go back to you. We haven't spent a lot of time talking about renewables, whether it's hydropower or whether it's sun or solar or wind. Do you see that as a, and we're talking about Pennsylvania, but do you see that as a sector of the energy grid that is going to be growing and has a future?
Absolutely. It's the dominant share of new power generation being installed in the United States, and it's a job sector that's only growing. And this is the case that a lot of environmental activists say against fracking, that, you know, all the things about the jobs and the economy that you make, those cases are much stronger with renewable energy. The Rocky Mountain Institute, which is an environmental think tank, they put out a report saying that renewables will be able to outcompete 80% of natural gas plants by 2035.
Wow.
So essentially that's only 15 years from now. So if you're building a new natural gas plant and you're basically not going to be competitive in less than 20 years, I mean, that's a pretty bad investment case. And that's, I think, something that a lot of, power operators are going to have to confront, that in a future where you may have a restriction on greenhouse gases, where you may have policies that limit it, renewables look much better and natural gas looks much worse for all of its upsides.
Reid, our first guest was saying that renewables, a small part of the energy package in Pennsylvania. Do you see it growing?
I mean, in fits and starts, I think a lot of environmental groups want to see the state take up a more aggressive renewable, it's this thing called a renewable portfolio standard. Actually, in Pennsylvania, it's called something else, alternative energy portfolio standard. But basically, it's mandating a certain percentage of your electricity comes from solar and wind and things like that. But, you know, Pennsylvania enacted what was at the time a fairly progressive, aggressive standard. But that was, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago or something. And it hasn't really been updated since. And so, you know, I think there's policy things that could happen in Pennsylvania that would push it more forward more aggressively. But so far, they haven't happened yet. And we'll see if they do. I just wanted to throw this out there because the question was asked. Landfill gas, I just looked it up. Landfill methane emissions are the third largest source in the U.S. of methane, and they account for about 14% of our emissions.
Fair enough. Thanks for doing all the fact-checking for us, Reed, during this hour. Here's an email from Nicholas who says, with the rate of gas leakage that's been measured, gas is doing more climate damage than coal. We need to keep that in perspective, especially as Trump rolls back methane leak limits. Is that true? Let me do a fact-check with you, Umair. Is that true?
On the rollbacks?
About methane leakage, yeah. Well, that's worse from natural gas. That is worse than coal.
I mean, this is the main point of contention. You know, the industry says that they're basically leaking maybe 1 or 1.5%, and some scientists estimate it at 3.5%. So there are vastly different estimates about how much they're leaking based on self-reporting and based on outside measurements. And that's part of why this has been a tough problem to easily resolve. But specifically, the Trump administration has also made that harder because they're rolling back things like the methane rule on public lands where that require, you know, measurement and validation of how much methane is leaking and measures to control it. So now we're even having fewer observations to validate one way or another.
Reed, let me go back to you, and this is a more political question, but if we're looking at Pennsylvania as a battleground state as it was in 2016, and clearly looks like it is in 2020, and if we're talking about jobs, you know, good union jobs in the natural gas industry, and Democrats want to bring, you know, win back the state in 2020, is this kind of what's at stake as Democrats take on Democrats?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Green New Deal and how closely Democrats in Pennsylvania sort of glom onto it or look at it as a legit way to do something about climate change. You know, if most Democrats in Pennsylvania look at it and say, this is just pie in the sky, it'll never happen, I think that hurts. This is just me opining here. I don't have much data here, but just from my conversations with folks. You know, there's other reasons besides fracking that people base their decisions on who to vote for, and that came up again and again in a lot of my conversations. You know, I'd ask people, okay, well, what are, you know, I would be talking to voters about this issue of would you support a candidate who wanted to ban fracking, and a lot of what they wanted to talk about was the sort of healthcare, the economy, and obviously a ban on fracking has something to do with it, but some people... You know, I talked to a Trump voter who used that lifelong Democrat, voted for Obama, then switched to Trump, and he's now thinking of switching back to the Democrats. And he really liked Bernie, and it seemed like the reasons he liked him were that he was good on trade, as far as he could see. That, you know, Bernie is more protectionist than typical or than a lot of Democrats. So, you know, I trying to understand which issues voters are going to find important or which way they're going to go in November, I kind of throw my hands up and say voters are all over the map. We can look at polls, but I don't have any great predictions for anybody.
Umair, I'm going to give you 15 seconds. Final thought.
Just that, like, it's been surprising just how much of a shift Democrats have made. If you look back at 2008, Obama was campaigning on more fracking, more drilling, and more oil extraction, and now we're talking about eliminating it entirely. It's been stunning how quickly politically this has changed.
Umair Irfan, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. He's a Vox staff writer covering climate change, energy, and the environment. Reed Frazier, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's an energy reporter for the Allegheny Front and State Impact Pennsylvania, co-host of the Trump on Earth podcast. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Susan Greenbaum is the producer of Radio Times Battleground 2020 series. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.